So, this is Inside the Bar Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. In this show, we'll be taking a look at some highly publicized cases from the Savannah area, as well as having some special guests come on and talk about related topics in prosecution, in law enforcement, and in victims' rights. And occasionally, we may indulge in an adult beverage or two. But for those of you who know me well enough to have suggested Prosecco and Prosecution as the name for this show, cheers. Inside the Bar Beyond a Reasonable Doubt is a study of violent crimes and the prosecution of those cases. The content may be disturbing for many. There may also be the occasional use of curse words. Listeners are warned. As a lawyer, I want to note that all of the opinions expressed on Inside the Bar are the opinions of the speaker. They should not be held against anyone else, and certainly should not be used as grounds for any sort of lawsuits or anything like that. The idea here is to create a platform where prosecutors and law enforcement have an opportunity to give their view on what is going on in the world and what has gone on in some of these cases. So, with that in mind, let's start. I'm beginning this show with a look at the trials of Jim Williams, which were made infamous in the book Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil and the movie of the same name. I chose this case because it is the first local example of big media distorting the truth to favor a killer. We will look at what many of the most popular accounts of this case left out, including the actual evidence and the courtroom testimony. Most people know Midnight, the book, and they know that it was written by so-called journalist John Barrett, and that it was advertised as nonfiction. By the end of this series, you'll know how misleading that label actually was for this case. Many of the myths about the case persist to this day and are still held by members of the bar. Hopefully, by the end of the series, you will understand or start to understand why prosecutors and law enforcement have such a strained relationship with big media. People don't know what goes on behind the scenes on big cases. If you want to know what really happened in a case, it's critical to sit down with the people who worked it. Steph Kirkland is one of those people, and he's done a deep dive into all things Jim Williams. I sat down with him more than once, because there's a lot to unpack here. And this is Inside the Bar. Beyond a Reasonable Doubt is a podcast. It is about prosecutors and law enforcement and the struggles that we face in getting the real stories told. And part of the reason that I wanted to establish this is that I want for us to have a platform, a place where we can talk about what really happens in investigations and in trials of real criminal cases. So I'm really excited to have on as my first real guest, Depp Kirkland. And Mr. Kirkland was a chief assistant district attorney here in Chatham County. And he helped to try one of the many Jim Williams cases and wrote a book about it called Lawyer Games. I think it's Lawyer Games After Midnight. Is that what you're calling it?
It is Lawyer Games After Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. So I tagged on to Mr. Barrett's book. Why not?
Why not? Because it's got.
It might as well have some benefit.
Exactly. And there's been a lot of marketing for that. So I think at some point we'll probably mention that. But I'm really excited to have you. So welcome. Can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Well, I'm from Savannah originally, born and raised here. Went to Savannah High School, thank you, Blue Jackets. And then I went off to the north, to the University of Michigan in chemical engineering. Decided I didn't want to do that because I didn't really like chemistry. So I eventually came back to Savannah, and I finished up at Georgia, and then I went to graduated Georgia Law School. And went to work, actually, right out of law school, I went to work in the DA's office.
here.
For, yes, here in Savannah for Mr. Ryan, we called
Bubsy.
Him. Bubsy's dad.
Bubsy's dad. Oh, okay.
Yeah, his dad was the head of the, and for 40 plus years since World War II period. You know, Mr. Ryan, fine gentleman, I'll tell you, one of the great people ever. Bubsy was his chief assistant at the time, so he was the trial lawyer.
No incest here.
Oh, no. Well, I can't imagine how he got that job. But, you know, Bubsy could try a case.
Yeah,
He could try a case. He had other issues, which came back to haunt him. But so I did that, and then I left the DA's office and went into private practice here in Savannah.
Who did you work with?
Well, I actually shared office space with Spencer Lawton and what is his name? His name now is Judge Karp.
Michael Karp.
Michael.
Yes, which, Buzzy.
Buzzy, as we call him. Buzzy Karp, Michael, and Spencer Lawton, and Marshall Wood. Four of us in the CNS Bank building.
Oh, wow.
And in the course of that, we began to discuss issues related to the DA's office where I had been and the problems they were having and particularly backlogs of criminal cases. Because here's the thing about Bubsy, and I don't want to disparage the man, but he, part of him, I kind of have I share this with him. I love the story. I love figuring out what happened. Well, he loved riding with the cops and figuring out the cases and trying the cases. As far as administration or keeping an eye on the docket or any of that stuff, no clue and no interest. There were, I don't know the numbers, so I don't want to tell you, but there were thousands of backlog untried cases from years ago.
Wow.
And I knew that, and I really knew that he wasn't his dad, and he wasn't the person to probably run that thing. So basically, they may deny this, but Buzzy and I talked Spencer into running against Bubsy Ryan.
Successfully.
I thought he was everything that office needed. Distinguished, smart, ethical. I mean, you just couldn't find a better human being, or more honorable sort of guy. So we talked him into it. He ran. He won. Spencer, I think he'd remember this, but his nickname is Landslide, because I think he won that election by maybe less than 20 votes. I mean, it was some ridiculous number.
Wow.
Barely won that election.
Wow.
Well, but he did. So then he says to me, well, now I've got to go run the place. So if I'm going over there, you're coming with me.
Awesome.
Yeah. So I went back into the DA's office as his chief assistant, his first chief.
And he got elected, was that 1981?
It was 1980, because it was right before this Williams murder happened.
Right.
So that was his introduction to DA.
Welcome to the world of prosecution.
Right.
And let me ask you this, because again, I, you and I have talked about this as a theme. I do believe that media attention kind of warps things. Prior to this case, in your experience, had you seen things in Savannah get the kind of media attention that this ended up getting?
No, never. The only one that may have been somewhat close was the Mercer kidnapping.
Right, which same house.
Same house. And, well, I don't know if they lived there. Maybe they did. I don't.
I don't get the impression they actually lived there.
The nephew or the grandson or whoever it was. But interestingly enough, the chief expert for the defense in the Williams case, Joe Burton, also testified in that case.
You mentioned that in your book.
Your book
has all kinds of details, which is super helpful, especially for anybody who's interested in what actually happened in court, which is not what's reflected in some other accounts.
No, it's not. But as far as media attention, no. And as you know, because you've done this actually much longer than I even did, is that they're people who cover the courthouse.
Right.
We call them shoes. You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Jan Scotch.
Then
the courthouse
reporter.
And he's fabulous. He would never, ever, I don't think he knows how to manipulate a story or a headline.
Mm-mm.
So as long as he was the guy, and it was the Savannah paper, you're fine.
Right.
Now, with Williams, it went far beyond that.
Right.
And
to
those
took
people,
a life of its own
my
altogether.
Goodness, it became... Who? What case are they? which kid, what are they talking about? Who are they talking about? And then, of course, as you know, I left. I went to work.
Yeah, how long were you in the DA's office as the chief?
The second time, I don't it was a couple of years, maybe two and a half. I don't remember exactly. We restructured things. I ran the trial teams and that sort of thing. And then I ended up, when Joe Frank Harris ran for governor, I got involved in his campaign and actually ran his campaign in Chatham County.
Wow.
Though I wasn't necessarily great at it. I ran Spencer's campaign. I'm going to show you how he's landslide. So,
hey,
you know, I'm not very good at that.
But, it worked.
So I did that. And then I went to Atlanta and worked for Joe Frank and ran the Consumer Council Office, Consumer Utility Council Office, and litigated utility cases on behalf of the public.
That doesn't sound like fun, actually.
it was an experience. And you want to talk about media and having a stake in the game and manipulating. I had editorials written about me in the Atlanta Journal complaining about my position in rate cases because of the power of Georgia Power and Southern Bell. And I mean, we went through the AT&T breakup. We went through the nuclear power plant Vogtle case.
Wow.
All of that stuff.
Well, your attention to detail definitely shows. I mean, it shows in your book, and I feel certain that it shows in all of your work. But I'm fascinated by your experience with Williams, and that's, of course, where I'm starting with this, because I do feel like it changed the landscape a little bit as far as how criminal trials in Savannah, at least some of them, have been covered.
I'm sure, yeah.
So tell me, first of all, because I obviously have read your book, tell me about what it was like as a prosecutor back in the day. Back in 1981 when this happened.
Well, that was a little odd. I mean, of course, well, you've done this for a long time, and, in fact, the technology has changed, the science has changed. Well, the science hasn't changed, but our understanding of it, the tools we have and that you had, changed quite a bit over time. I mean, the whole DNA
everything,
evolution.
Yeah.
All of that. Back in those days, Savannah was a quiet little place. It's not quiet today, mainly because of Williams and the Berndt book and this discovery that Savannah, his tourists have made of this city. So, which is wonderful. Come see it. It's amazing. It's beautiful. But
it's not as warped as they say.
There are no ghosts here. And, as I say, I think in my book, that the whole idea that there's, Danny Hansford, who's the victim in the Williams case, is somehow roaming Bonaventure Cemetery. And I think I make the comment in the book that I have quite a few generations of relatives buried in Bonaventure, and they tend to stay there. I have not seen any of them come back. But back then, it was pretty routine. Everybody knew everybody. The detectives, the police department, all these people. The chief investigator for the DA's office, J.D. Smith, was in fact, a former officer, and had come over there. One of the great people ever.
Oh, I love J.D. I mean, and in fact, small town that Savannah sometimes is, it's a little bit of both. His parents lived next door to my husband growing up.
Oh my God, so, of course they did.
That's just the way it is.
But it was pretty quiet. Now, I left after the first trial, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. And it leads to why there's so much detail in this book, because the way I got involved in the case in the first place was I was called in the middle of the night.
Because that was the norm back then.
That was
the
norm.
The police would call you, right?
They would call you, but they didn't call you for just anything. So I got a phone call from Detective Reagan, actually, Everett Reagan.
Another great guy.
Another great guy. Terrific, terrific guy. I don't think I can tell you what he does today, but
he actually retired.
Oh,
he very recently, he was investigator for the DA's office for a while under Meg, and then he went to be the commander of the counter-narcotics team for a good long time.
Yeah, he was behind a fence that you couldn't talk about.
Right, and so now he is retired from that. I'm trying to get him to come on my show, but I haven't been able to get him.
He should do that.
I want him to do it. We'll
see. Terrific. In fact, ask him. You can ask him about the third Williams trial.
Oh, yes.
And I can give you a quote that he gave me much after that had happened about why that jury was hung.
Sure we're going to get to that.
He will be very entertaining.
Yeah.
But what happened was I got a phone call in the middle of the night. I think it was 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, whatever time it was. I lived in Trustees Garden, so it's not that far. They said, we've got a case. You need, you know, we'd like you to come over and take a look at it because it doesn't seem right. Something's off. And it's at Jim Williams' house, at Mercer House. So I've got an address. It's for something, whatever, Bull Street. I go there. I don't know Jim Williams from anybody. You know, so the idea that
you were not one of these rich people going to the parties?
Nope. I didn't know anything about him. I knew some connection to Telfair and the Arps and all that sort of thing, but I didn't know who he was. So the whole idea that it was his persecution, which came out later, became this whole thing about Spencer Lawton is after this man. It's total horse something, because Spencer...
It's so nice of you to edit yourself. I struggle with that. I might have to put...
Not easy.
Know, yeah.
Some bleeps. Yeah, some bleeps. That's a kind of dress things
I
up
might
a
just
bit.
Put E for explicit on an episode just say whatever I feel
You can
like.
Always put the bleeps. You can put the bleeps in there anyway.
That's true.
Even if they're not, you know.
That's true.
So I go to the scene, and here... So the point being about the Spencer's whatever it is, crusade against Williams. Spencer was not the person who decided to arrest him. I was. So I went to the scene. I walk inside, and the place is a little bit trashed. There's some things thrown around. And over to the right in the parlor is Jim Williams sitting there with his attorney. I'm like, well, that's interesting.
His attorney was Bob Duffy at that time?
Bob Duffy at that time.
And I do remember Mr. Yeah. Duffy.
Mr. Duffy was there. Interestingly enough, he was there long before the police were. Isn't that interesting? So
yeah,
anyway,
yeah, I've heard some things.
Well, so here's Jim Williams sitting there quite calm, and here's Everett Reagan and Joe Jordan and at the time Corporal Anderson, Mike Anderson, who's passed away since, a great guy as well. He was the one who answered the call.
I've read about him.
Yeah. Terrific guy. And so, well, over here in the study, as they called it. So if you go to if you go to Mercer House now, you walk in the hallway, in the entrance hall, the room to the left, if you walk up about maybe 30 feet, the door to the left goes into what was then the study where this happened.
Okay.
It's doesn't look the same today.
Oh, okay.
Right. So if you're going to Mercer House to get to revisit the scene, you're not going to revisit the scene. In fact, I understand they don't even let you talk about it.
But that's really?
No. So that's the setup.
Because you do have some pictures.
I have
some
it
of
as
the crime
it was.
Scene pictures.
Yes, I do.
And that's being a geek, and I have to just throw this in there. You clearly are a forensics person, and I tend to be that person too.
No doubt about it.
You know, whenever I've helped somebody with a trial, even if it's not my trial, I end up doing the medical examiner or the forensics people because I love it. And so looking at the real pictures is...
It is the thing.
Yeah.
And in the pictures, in my opinion, I have a presentation I do about this thing I've done to some prosecutors. But I think you could have won that case with 4 photographs.
Oh, probably.
Didn't need testimony. There are 4 photographs.
One, you know,
well, you
I could win
that.
That case in 4 pictures.
You could. The court reporter... who took 3 of the trials, not all 4, but 3 of the 4 trials.
Barbara Wright, who
Barbara
I also
Wright.
Know. Lovely person.
I talked to Barbara, and I asked her, because the real question, and Anna, we got a little bit ahead of ourselves, there were 4 trials, 4 murder trials. So by the time of the last one in Augusta, that was moved and then tried in Augusta, where he was acquitted. Now, we'll get to that. But I asked Barbara, because Barbara was there. She didn't try. I forget which one she didn't take, but she took that one. And I said, was there anything different? Because something had to have changed. I have no idea how this man could ever have been acquitted of this crime, because it is physically, speaking of forensics, impossible that he did not do it. It just, and I can go through
oh,
that.
Yeah,
it takes
no.
2 seconds to
yeah.
do that.
Please do it.
It's very easy. As she said, not really, except for the fact that the testimony of some of the experts, particularly Dr. Larry Howard, who ran the crime lab at the time. He had retired by then, but he was the guy, forensic genius, and Detective Reagan, that the testimony of these people was so restricted that they weren't allowed to reach any conclusions because of some things that happened in the Supreme Court that we also could talk about. There's an entire controversy about what happened behind the scenes with the Williams case in the Supreme Court and George
yeah.
T. Smith and the...
Yeah.
Governor Sanders and this and that and the phone call I got from somebody in Atlanta about that. It's a whole different
right.
story. But she said to me, which I thought was fascinating, She said, "You know that photograph of the chair on the pants leg of Danny Hansford?" I said, "Yeah, I know it quite well." She said, "I believe you could have blown that photo up, hung it from the ceiling, and said the prosecution rests." Now, you wouldn't do that.
No, we would never do that.
Only in television you might do that, but not in real life.
Right, in real life, because the burden of proof is so high, and I think this is something the public does not fully grasp, we're not ever going to just sit down.
No, you don't know when you've got it. You don't know. You have to.
You can't know.
There's something I'll share with you that's sort of, it's on topic, but I may not have mentioned it in the book. The fellow by the name of Vincent Bugliosi.
Yes.
Used to be the lead prosecutor in L.A. County.
Wrote Helter Skelter. Right.
Tried the Manson family.
Right.
And convicted them.
Yes.
When he wasn't even at the scene. I mean.
Yeah.
He tried, 100 murder cases. He never lost a case. He was obsessive.
Mm-hmm.
Had 100-page closing arguments, which then he would throw away. But he was so in detail-oriented. You talked about detail-oriented. Mm-hmm. This man was detail-oriented. Well, it always bothered him that the charge to the jury was about beyond a reasonable doubt. The prosecution must prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt. And, of course, defense lawyers will hammer that, as I would. And I have.
Right, of course.
I've done defense work, too.
Sure.
You hammer it. You're looking for any sliver of doubt. Any sliver of doubt.
Right.
He got to the point where he actually convinced felony judges in L.A. County to change that instruction. Because he says, if you think about it, beyond a reasonable doubt is not the test. And it creates an impression that the prosecution has to go further than they really have to go. So he got the juries, he got the judges to start charging, to use a charge that said, to the exclusion of all reasonable doubt. Which basically means if you have no reasonable doubt left, you must convict. Which is really the test.
That's an interesting way to approach it. I've made a number of arguments over the years about what the standard is, and most of them I just make to the jury. So,
right.
But I would talk about, what do I have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt? Do I have to prove the color of their shirt? No.
Right.
Go through the things that I don't have to prove, just a couple of those easy examples.
I've got a good one for you from the O.J. Simpson trial, actually.
Mm. Do you have to prove that the glove fits? No.
No. After the case was over, there was an interview, number of interviews done, but I forget which network carried this, but it was an interview with the foreperson of the jury.
Mm.
Okay.
Mm.
And they asked her about one particular thing.
Mm-hmm.
There were blood drops found at the scene of the killing. They were matched to O.J. Simpson. They were found before the detectives they all wanted to jump on ever showed up at the scene. Okay, yeah. The glove was there from the beginning, the one with the blood on it. There were 4 blood drops on the walkway that were identified as DNA. There was blood on the back fence, identified by DNA test, 99.99,000% positive that it was O.J. Simpson's blood.
Yep.
They asked her about that. How did you deal with the fact that his blood was at the crime scene? And she said, well, we didn't really deal with that because that was not the reasonable doubt that we found. Now,
they went looking for reasonable
doubt.
They
went looking for something to doubt. So what you're talking about, and this is back to Mr. Bugliosi again, another thing, talking about a rope versus a chain.
Yeah.
It is what the defense will tell you is that the evidence is a chain. And if any link in that chain is broken, the case falls. He said it's not. It's like a rope. And you can take a strand off. You can take another strand off. You can take another strand off. The question is the rope still strong enough? That's the way you look at it, but they're not going to tell you that.
No.
So they think that if they create doubt about any piece of the evidence,
right,
that then the case falls.
Right.
And it doesn't. That's not the test.
Right.
The problem with, as you mentioned, the media, most people who cover these cases, there are exceptions. Most people who cover these cases don't have the level of understanding of the system that they should. and they let this stuff go.
Yeah.
They don't get it.
Right. Well, and then they perpetuate these myths that are really damaging to the truth, which is the truth-seeking function of the jury is what we talk about.
Right.
And of course, you know, we've also, you and I have discussed that the defense bar is not held to that truth-seeking function in the same manner that prosecutors and law enforcement are.
No, they're not.
And so because of that, the whole process has become distorted, and I think the media has enhanced that as a problem. But anyway, I'm sorry. I'm getting off topic here.
I think it's a good topic,
and I think it's something we need to talk about. But let's talk about what you saw
at this house. So here we are at the house, and they say there's something not right about this scene. So I walk in. Danny Hansford's laying there, face down, pool of blood. And so they walk me through the evidence. Well, what the scene.
Now, there's an allegation there, like a bunch of people in this room. Is that
good
true?
God, no. The room was sealed. They stationed. It wasn't Anderson, because Anderson was the responding officer. He was in charge. But I forget the name of the officer who was stationed at the door to allow no one in or out. So the only people in there, Detective Reagan, Detective Jordan, and at this point myself.
Was there a forensics officer?
Forensics officer came in.
Is that Ms. Stevens? Do I have that right?
Dora Stevens, yeah.
Right, okay.
She was there taking pictures. And she got there actually before the detectives did. Police officers first, Anderson and his group first. Then Officer Stevens.
No, wait. You said his group. There must have been like 50 people,
oh,
right?
God, no.
And SPD then was much tinier, too, than it is now.
Well, this came up later, so I'm a little bit out of sequence.
I know.
But the police station then was the one that's downtown that has the old car in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's
on Haversham, right?
Yeah, on Haversham. They got the call and arrived. The time that the call came in, the 911 call when Williams eventually called the police, and the time they arrived at Mercer House was 90 seconds.
Yeah.
Okay. They got there 90 seconds after he called them.
Yeah.
They walked up. It was Anderson and another officer who arrived. They walked up to the front door at the same time as Williams' friend, Joe Goodman,
right,
who had come from the south side, who he had called first. He then called his lawyer. And at some point, maybe a half hour or more later, he calls the police while his supposed friend and lover is laying on the floor dying. Probably dead already.
Well, right.
But, okay, so.
That headshot probably killed him pretty quickly.
Yes, it severed his aorta.
Right.
Well, the one to the chest severed his aorta.
Right.
The headshot was probably actually second on the way down, and then the shot through the back directly down into the floor perpendicular from the above the body was probably just a coup de grace, we call it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I go into the room, and the first thing they point out is Hansford is laying down, face down, his feet are at the eastern end of the desk that Williams sat at, used as in his study. There is an antique chair, heavy, curved arm, upholstered antique chair. It's placed over, it's on top of his body. It's on top of the rear of his, up to almost to his waist.
Right. So, and I'm glad you're describing it, because when I saw the picture, and I'd read your description, but once you see the picture,
it's unmistakable.
Yeah. There's no way that chair could have gotten
it.
He
is so far up
there.
He would have to have fallen down. Now, first of all, the first shot that we think was to the chest, severed his aorta. He died within seconds. He was dead. He dropped to the ground.
Wow.
His heart lost. This is all testimony.
Right. And
heart lost volume.
Williams even admitted that the chest shot was the first shot,
yes.
Right? So, yeah. Okay, great. Sorry.
So,
go ahead.
He hits him. He'd have to fall to the ground. And then while dead, crawl backwards up underneath this chair. And then secondly, the telling part was that the rear leg on the northeast corner of the chair was securely on top of a significant segment of Hansford's pants leg, pinning it to the carpet.
So these were like almost bell-bottom kind of pants.
Yes, they had a little flex at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So he would have had to die, roll backwards, somehow lift the chair up from the rear, put it on top of his pants leg, put it back down again, and then become a ghost or continue being dead.
Well, and there was no blood smear or anything like that that would suggest that he moved
not at all.
From the time he hit the ground.
All the blood was right around him. All
well,
the blood
other than the smear
underneath.
On his hand. Sorry.
Yes.
We'll get to that.
And we'll get to that. So I see this guy laying down. I see the chair first. And I say, that is not right. And it took a while to figure out what it had to have meant. But obviously, that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. Somebody put that chair on top of him. Mm-hmm. And then later, we started to ask, why would they have done that? Why would Williams have put the chair on top of him? And we'll get to that. But the other thing that was so obvious immediately is that Hansford's right hand, his left arm and hand were underneath the body. And as you know from having done this, there's a thing that's called, a death spasm, that typically when someone's shot, their hands will clasp like, it's like someone who has a severe arthritis, maybe. The hands will clench. Fingers will clench, and they'll reach, and they'll be trapped against their chest, particularly if they're shot in the chest. It's a heart thing. So his left arm and left hand are underneath his body. We don't see it yet because he hasn't been moved, but his left hand is clenched, you know, his left fist is clenched. His right hand is out, and it's laid on top of a 9mm World War II vintage Luger.
It's also clenched, though, isn't it?
The fingers
are clenched.
Are curved, but they're not fully clenched, but they're curved. And the thumb, and they're laying on top of the handle of the pistol. They're not gripping the gun at all. They're laid on top of it. I say laid on top of it, that's probably presuming something, but they are
not
on top of it.
Not based on looking at the picture. I mean,
they are on top of the pistol. All right. There is blood in the palm of Hansford's hand. You look, pick it up, and you look. There is blood in the palm of his hand.
You can see some of it even.
You can see a little bit. In the web between the thumb and the forefinger. There's no blood on the handle of the weapon. Now, there's plenty of blood underneath him, and there's a blood smear on the back of his hand. You can see that the blood has been smeared. And if you live in Brooklyn, that's a smear is what you put cream cheese on a bagel. But this is a smear of blood. Actually, it's actually a smear. But here it's a smear. A smear of blood in the back of the hand. Like, well, how did that get there?
Yeah.
Well, how it gets there is because the hand was pulled out from under the body, and the fingers were straightened, but not enough, and placed on top of this pistol that was laid there. Okay.
Yeah.
That's two things. Now, this gets to be the fun part.
Like it wasn't fun already.
Well, it was
Come
fun
on.
Already. But already, it's like, No. This is not right. No, something's wrong. No, this is not what he said happened. Couldn't possibly be what happened. So then I'm looking around, and there's the desk. And on the desk is another vintage World War II Luger.
Did you know these were vintage World War II Lugers when you saw them?
I knew they were Lugers. Because you've seen TV. I mean, they're pretty distinctive.
Right.
But the fact they were actual antiques, you know, World War II vintage, no. I had no idea.
I mean, you're looking around the house. It's probably,
Who keeps these? Who keeps weapons? Oh, there were others. And I'm going to get to where another one was.
Yeah.
So I'm looking around the desk, and the Luger's placed on the desk right in front of the chair William said he was sitting in. His story was, that they were there late at night. They'd been to the drive-in. Danny had God knows how many. I mean, he exaggerates, but Danny had been smoking, I don't know how many joints of marijuana. And
yeah, I think it changes a number of times.
It changes. The story changes over time. I also did ask the question about whether he was in the car with Danny while he was smoking all this marijuana, because apparently Williams didn't inhale. But anyway, Danny was a mess, and they came home, and they got into this violent argument over some trip, which actually didn't happen, but they got into this big argument over a trip. They were supposed to go to Europe the next day or the day after, and Danny went into a rampage, and that he went out somewhere in the house and started trashing things, and then came back in with this Luger and fired at Williams trying to kill him.
There was a line that you're leaving out where I think Danny is supposed to have said something that sounds like dialogue.
Oh, my goodness. why don't you go back? Why don't you just die and go? I forget exactly what the word is, but yeah, it's like bad dialogue from a bad movie.
It's something about like, I might be leaving here, you know,
but you're leaving tonight
or something.
Yeah. Like, oh something. Yeah. It was something like that. Yeah. And now I make movies. So that was one of the worst written pieces of dialogue you could ever. Williams was like that. He was very dramatic.
I've heard that he's very dramatic in the courtroom.
Very dramatic in the courtroom. Well, that doesn't always play well if you're a defendant, but he couldn't help himself. He just thought that he thought, and he was sitting in that study, not in the study, in the foyer, in the other part of there with his attorney, the most calm, peaceful, legs crossed, like nothing in the world was a problem.
I envision him like with a cigarette in a holder.
He didn't, but he should have.
Yeah.
He didn't. Very distinguished guy. I mean, you know, he certainly played the part. He was a very well-known antique dealer, and he'd known nationwide and all of that. He was also probably a sociopath. But, so we're looking around this desk. Here's this other Luger. And he had admitted, he said, Danny came in, he was raging. Okay, that was the thing came back time and time again and time again in every case. Raging. He was raging. He went into a rage. And you don't know when he got like that. He was a rage. Anyway, came in raging, supposedly fired at Williams with this Luger. Williams then managed to obtain his own Luger from a drawer in a little chest next to his desk.
That's more or less a matching Luger? I mean, they aren't matching, obviously. But
they looked identical. I mean, they look the same. They're, you know, I don't know. Like I say, all look fairly much alike. So he manages to open this drawer in this thing, get his Luger out, and return fire. And I don't know what Danny's doing. Oh, Danny, he says that the gun jammed. So he manages...
Well, that was... He only said the gun jammed like
later.
The third trial.
Later. So he gets... He manages to obtain his own Luger and returns fire. He hits Danny once. He goes to the ground. He shoots at him again. And he said he shot, I don't know, four or five... He didn't know how many times. Okay. Well, it was three. And the last one we'll get to, which is rather interesting.
Yeah.
But all of that from behind the desk. Then he put the Luger down on the desk, and he went around to see what had happened. Well, or whatever. I don't know how he has his exact words with me, but, you know, just to investigate all of this. And then he decided to call his friend Joe Goodman, who was just somebody he'd known since the kid was, you know, since he was young. And Joe used to do things for him and do errands. And he took him under his wing and, you know, whatever.
I think there was some testimony at some point that there was some sexual relationship, but it hadn't continued.
Well, it didn't continue because Joe actually gave a statement to the police and to others about that. Did you ever have a sexual relationship? He said, and it was when he was a teenager. He said, yeah, but it didn't do anything for me. So I didn't really, it didn't, you know, I wasn't, you know, he tried it. Joseph, I mean, he's a very interesting guy.
I'm sure.
He just didn't, no. Well, that was what Williams did, so I'm sure he tried it with Joe, and Joe just, you know, wasn't into it. So, and so when he came to the scene that night, he was with his girlfriend, a living girlfriend. So he was not.
Joe was,
okay. Yes.
And he got there the same time as the police, and you got there like sometime after, is that
right? I got there, well, then the forensics showed up, she started taking pictures, then Detective Reagan and
Jordan
came up, got there, and actually directed her to take additional pictures of the things that we had noticed. So she started taking more pictures. And the pictures will come into play later with Mr. Sonny Seiler in a very interesting way. Mm. So that's the so I'm looking at the desk, and I'm saying, so tell me again what he says happened. Well, he says that Hansford did this. He came in here, and he fired in there. Interesting. Because what had happened was that whoever fired the weapon that was under Danny Hansford's hand, that bullet had hit the top of the desk. It had gone through some papers, ricocheted off of a belt buckle that was underneath. It was a brass memorabilia thing. It was under. There was a lot of stuff on the desk.
Right.
Went through this stack of papers, ricocheted off of this belt buckle, ricocheted up and into the northeast corner and made a mark on the wall and then fell to the ground, and it was, you know, the bullet was down there somewhere. Mm. Now, what happened was when the bullet went through these papers, it created paper fragments, a shower of paper fragments. So I'm standing there behind the desk. I'm looking at this Luger. Mm-hmm. And I said to Reagan, I said, it looks like there's paper on top of this gun.
Which Luger are we talking about?
The one on Williams' desk.
So the one on William's desk, is that the one that Williams fired?
That is the one that Williams fired. Mm. I say, this is the one he used to defend himself, right? After Danny had fired at him with the other one.
How would the paper have gotten there?
Oh, well, gee. And I said that to them. I said, how does the paper get on top of the gun that was fired second, supposedly? And he says, I don't know, but that's a very good question. I don't know what Reagan said. He probably said, huh. I mean, I don't know.
But I've got to tell you, you can see him in some of these pictures, and I never remember him being that blonde. So
he was not that old then. He had some experience, a good bit of experience, but he was a young guy. And I never came out in any of the trials, I don't think, because he was standing there too. And I said, look at that. And he looked at that. So he testified about it. But I'm the one who found the paper fragments.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, that's interesting. Okay.
Click, take a picture.
Can't have happened. Mm-hmm. That can't have happened.
Right. And so how did you know what the version was at that point?
Williams had told them what had happened.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He showed up, let's see. Anderson
showed up. Because I know he gave a ton of statements.
Oh, my good God. Clear. Oh, good Lord. Yes, Corporal Anderson showed up, and Williams said, I shot him. He's in the study. Basically, that's what he said. And okay. He let him in there, and then another officer who was with Anderson, I don't remember his name. I had it, but I just don't have it
mm-hmm.
with me.
Sure.
Anderson came out of the study at one point, and Williams was talking to this guy. To this mm-hmm. police officer, and he went over and told him to stop. He said, you can't, no, don't talk to him anymore, and it was part of that.
Okay.
And then he filed supplementals and about what Williams had said about what had happened, that Hansford attacked him, he was in a rage, he turned fire, boom. Okay, so I tell them, and they say, well, that's why we called you, because mm-hmm. of who he is, really. I mean, they didn't say that, but he's one of the most prominent citizens of this city and known by everybody.
Well, right.
And, you know, they didn't say to me, you know, but you know why I was there. The reason I was there was because this doesn't look right, but here's what he says, so what do we do?
Right.
So I then walked across the hall to where Williams was sitting with his attorney, Mr. Duffy, to inform them, to inform Duffy. I didn't tell Williams this. I told Duffy that the police were going to arrest his client. He said, well, for what? And I said, for murder. And Williams looks up at me and says, this I never figured out. Williams looks up at me and he said, he was dumbfounded. And he says, if I'd wanted to shoot anybody, I could have shot you. There's another gun right here in this. It was another pistol in the drawer of the table next to the sofa where he was sitting.
You know,
Didn't make a lot of sense.
No, but it raises one of those, like, modern day kinds of questions, like when you're securing a crime scene,
you might want to be within the reach of the accused. You might want to think that there's no weapon within.
Yeah, you might ask him that question, like, are there any guns around here? Do I need to be checking?
Might give you some sense of who he was.
Yeah, but, right, because he's getting the what we would in these days call white privilege.
Well, certainly the
deference. The deference.
I could imagine some citizens, actually, even of Savannah, who were very prominent and they're black, and they would have gotten this treatment.
Yeah, but well, it is true. What we it's a doll. Deference thing. Yeah.
It is a deference thing. It's all about who's who.
Yeah.
And you go to another country where all the colors are different, and it's the same thing. It's
right.
about power and money and influence and who's who.
Sure.
And yes, there are other examples of what you're talking about every day.
Right.
But in this case,
and here,
and here. But in this case, it was all about who he was. So. He says, all right, what are we going to do? And I said, well, he's going to be arrested. And he says, well, what about, what about bail? I said, bail, all right, well, let's see. So they woke up Judge Gadson, and we went to his house. I did this. Why did I do this? I should have just said, well, call the court in the morning. I don't know. I was young.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think I'd be
I don't think you'd have done that.
They
said, well, would you be willing to, if I can get a judge, would you be willing to, you know, and I said, well, yeah, if you can get a judge, but it's the middle of the night. All right.
You were probably thinking they weren't going to get
it. I didn't think they were going to get a judge out of bed. Well, they did. So they get Judge Gadson out of bed. So we go to his house, and he's got he's in a different kind of robe. Not the one you typically see him in.
I'm sure he was thrilled to see you.
We have a bond hearing.
In his house. That's ridiculous.
In his house. And I forget the bond. I have it somewhere in my book, but I forget what the number was.
And lower than it should have been.
Lower than it should have been. I mean,
even for the change in economic status.
Well, he also had a trip scheduled to Europe that was supposed to happen in 2 days. So
and
he had to give up his
we're
passport.
We're letting this happen?
Actually, I think he actually went on the trip.
Right. I mean, a lot of me is dumbfounded by procedurally what happened here. So,
very special person. So
apparently,
Williams calls back to the house to Joe Goodman, who's still there.
Mm-hmm.
And says, Joe, you know where I keep my money. He says, yeah. And he has a safe at his house. And Joe goes and gets, I think it was $25,000 in cash in a paper bag and takes it down to the jail and bails him out.
Right, because I think it was, I'm going by the way I understood bonds, like a $250,000 bond you'd have to secure with 10%, whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
It could be 25 grand or property or whatever it was. I think it was 25 grand in cash. He takes it in a paper sack down to this. I mean, this was all just crazy. What do I know?
World is insane.
By then, I've gone home, thank God. And that was the beginning of this case. And I don't think Williams ever thought that he was going to be arrested. I don't think he had any clue that this was going to happen to him.
From what has been described in your book and by other people that I've talked to about this, he just sounded so shocked that anyone would doubt him.
Yes,
he's
absolutely.
Some sort of special person.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
He was very special.
And, I know that they're, as lawyers, we get all excited about, a lot of these very legal details. But we have, four trials here. There's a lot of legal details. But your book is called Lawyer Games. And I don't want to, belabor too many of these legal details because I think, your average Joe might not understand them. But there's a lot of stuff they are going to understand. And so you handled... you and Spencer tried the first Williams trial.
Yes.
And in that trial, can you give me some highlights of things that jumped out at you as being...
Oh, my goodness.
Inappropriate. Well, now, of course, you also have different lawyers. I mean, they...
Right.
This,
they
this
changed
first
later.
Team.
Right.
So who's on the first team?
First team. First people that show up in town it's Bobby Lee Cook.
And he recently died, from what I understand.
Did he? Because
I think
used
it was like
check.
Last week or something.
Well, it was very recent then, because I used to check from time to time. He was going to the office still at 90 whatever plus. And at the time of this trial, I think he had tried somewhere over 500 murder cases. He represented the Vanderbilts. He was one of the. He worked out of an office up in Tennessee somewhere, or I think it was, where was it? North Georgia. Had a little, the goatee, the quote Shakespeare. That guy who would come in and flourish, and he'd bring his people in. And he, much like Williams, I think expected just to have people fall down and bow and be intimidated.
On some level, that happens, though.
It does happen.
And
it does happen.
I've had that experience, and clearly you had that experience in this case, and I do need to mention that Judge Oliver tried this case. I know him. He was a lovely, lovely man, or I knew him. But...
Judge
he
Oliver
would give deference
had
to a
trouble
lot of people.
With these people.
Yeah.
Judge Oliver was, in my opinion, too nice. In fact,
he was too nice to be a judge.
He was too nice to be a judge. What did he like to do? He liked to go to the beach on the weekend. Everybody saw him. He was down there every week, strolling the beach, saying hello to everybody. One of the kindest, nicest men I've ever known. I tried a lot of cases with him. He was on both sides. I defended cases in front of him, and he got into a little trouble. With a couple of those that he didn't appreciate me pointing out sentences that he had imposed that he now was saying he'd never done. Anyway, but he was such a kind man, but he did not like, he wanted everybody to get along.
Yes.
And he once told me, believe it or not, he might have put a spin, I don't think it was Spencer, but he told me this. He said, I am counting on you to make sure I don't get reversed.
Oh, he said that to me. Because he tried some cases as a senior
he
judge.
He was looking to the prosecutor to keep him keep him okay.
Yes.
So he'd look to you. It'd be an objection. He'd actually look over, look at you, do you have anything to say? Because he didn't really necessarily want, and he didn't want to go after these people. He made a ruling in this case, in the second trial, that I will never understand, but I know why he did it.
Right.
He was...
he didn't like people yelling at him.
He didn't like anybody yelling.
Yes.
And he didn't like having questions that he wasn't really sure about how to do. Well, in the third trial, he did something that maybe if he'd gone a little further, I think it could have turned out differently. But very kind man. So here comes Bobby Lee Cook, who was all blustery and this and that.
And John he's got Wright, a reputation for being wonderful.
Huge reputation. John Wright Jones was local counsel, lawyer.
I actually never knew John Wright Jones. Yeah. I've heard about him.
Great, big guy, kind of like John Calhoun. I mean, very forceful, very,
John Calhoun, I knew.
But a nice guy. But but don't turn your back on any of these people. I mean, come on. I have this thing I do, and I mentioned it to you earlier. I do that's it's called the American Criminal Jury Trial, a playground for legal delinquents. And I've made this presentation.
Yeah.
It's a presentation that I do, and one of those, and I talk about the lawyer toolkit, the defense lawyer toolkit. There are a number of items. About bait and switch, this and that, this and that. And the last one on my last slide I talk about is the snake in the suit. And it's a picture of Bobby Lee Cook. So be careful. And when I first, this is not in the book. I don't think this is in the book. But when I first started practicing law in Savannah, somebody told me, I think I know who it was, but I don't want to say because if I'm wrong, I don't want to say the wrong name. But somebody told me, and this was about Sonny Seiler, Frank Seiler, who ended up coming onto the case after you know, Cook left, told me back then, he said, I don't know what to tell you, but do not turn your back on him if you have a case with him. And, you know, I only tried civil cases, so I never did have anything to do with him.
Right.
But that was what I had heard. Well, right. Bobby Lee Cook, okay. So what happens? They come to town. They sweep into town like the king and his court. And they're ready to try this case. Well, Joseph Burton, who was the medical examiner for Cobb and DeKalb counties at the time, did a lot of work for the defense.
Which is interesting in and of itself.
Isn't it interesting?
Yes.
He ended up as the medical examiner in 5 counties around Atlanta. He had a stable of Arabian horses. Now tell me where he got those.
The money for those.
The money for those. Mm. So anyway, so he comes with Joe Burton. They come to town, and I'm here, I'm this young assistant, I'm building this case, I've got what I think is my case. I'm like, where's the defense?
Right.
Where are they? They filed some motions, we had some motion hearings, fine. I think he sent his daughter to argue those. Where's the big guy? Who am I supposed to be here? We're supposed to try this case. Well, this is the week before the trial. Joe Burton, their expert witness on pretty much every topic, shows up in town. Goes over to the state crime lab to take a look at the evidence. This is
the Friday before trial.
I'm thinking, so I get a call. Well, guess what? The defense is here. I said, what are they doing? Because by that time, I'd been to Atlanta. We had taken the evidence had been up there. We'd fire tested these guns. We had forensic. We had gunshot residue information, which is very unique in this case.
Right.
All this material, all this stuff, the state crime lab, all over it. And yet we had not heard from these people. Now, I have to tell you, first of all, what I did, and this is before the trial happened because it's kind of interesting, about Dr. Larry Howard, who was the head of the state crime lab at the time, a legend in this business.
Mm-hmm.
So I took the photos, some of them, that you've seen in the book, the photos that are in the book, not all of them, though, but the photos of the scene.
Mm-hmm.
J.D. Smith and I took those photos, and we drove to Atlanta, and we went to see Dr. Howard at the state crime lab. So I said, okay, I want you to take these pictures, and then we're going to leave, and then we're going to come back. So we take off. I gave him the pictures. We go away. We get some lunch, JD and I, whatever. And then we go back.
Mm-hmm.
And we go in, and I'm looking at Dr. Howard. And I said, what do you think? And he looks up at me, and he says, the son of a bitch is lying.
Had you told him what the story was?
No, I didn't tell him anything.
Wow.
Okay. I said, it's a self-defense case. I said, I did say the guy supposedly attacked him, the gun. I told him what Williams had said happened.
Right.
I didn't tell him what we thought.
Right.
I said, here's what he says happened. You tell me. It's the son of a bitch is lying.
Yeah.
Like, okay, that's pretty positive
stuff. Helps.
And why? And he goes through the gun, the hand, the blood. No, couldn't happen. So then he asked me about the pistols themselves. And I said, gunshot stuff. And he says, well, typically it doesn't matter. It doesn't mean anything. But we need
gunshot residue?
Gunshot residue. But we need to test the weapon.
Right.
And then we'll know. And he'd done a lot of that. He'd done hundreds of weapons tests because that was his thing.
Right.
The forensic guy, that's what he did. It was his hobby. And all right. Those. So we go back to Savannah now.
It's interesting. Gun guys tend to be gun guys.
Yeah. It doesn't matter. It's not about this case, that case. I mean, so here comes Bobby Lee Cook, and they sweep in, blah, blah, blah. So we start the trial. I'm thinking, okay, here's Joe Burton. I'm thinking, am I crazy, or is there a problem with the fact that he really hasn't looked at this evidence? And he doesn't know any. He hasn't tested the weapon. He hasn't done any kind of – he hasn't looked at the photos that I – well, I guess he'd looked at the photos. We must have given them to him. I'm sure they had those.
And let me ask that, too, because, of course, by the time I came in, I started prosecuting in 1994. And that was when the discovery rules in Georgia came into play. Mm-hmm. And because before that, it was basically like, you know, you had to turn over scientific reports,
statements
of the defendant,
right,
and that's about it.
Yep.
So,
and that came into play in this case.
Right, it did.
Because what you used to do in the day, in the back in those days, to give them, and it got involved with the reversal of the first conviction, actually, which was mm-hmm. my fault. Spencer says not, but I still say it was my fault.
So all this whole book problem is your fault?
Well, yeah, I don't know about that. But
the fact that we had four trials, if you just had one trial.
Just got
trial.
The first one was pretty solid, as far as my opinion. But
right. What
happened in those days was, yes, you would give them statements of the defendant. Well, mm-hmm. to give them the statement of the defendant, what we would do is we would actually take the report where the police officer, typically a detective, had written down the statement, or if it had been transcribed, and right. that would be different, we'd give them that.
Right.
But typically, it was actually in a supplemental report from a detective who had interviewed the defendant, if they had that. Or in this case, the statements were made at the scene. So whatever he had said at the scene.
Right. So you didn't have body cam.
No.
You didn't have
body cam.
Recorded statements.
No.
You didn't have video. You didn't have, so none
had,
of that.
If they had gone to the police station or the jail or whatever, and he had given a statement later,
right.
they would have recorded on tape. They didn't have video, but they did record, and that came
on
up,
audio. It, right.
Audio. This came up later in this case, too. Mm-hmm. But in that case, we would take the report itself, and we would redact everything that they weren't entitled to see,
right.
because the defense didn't have any right to see what we had that he didn't know we had.
Right.
And we would give them the actual report because that was the best evidence. It was the best example of what was done because it was written at the time by the officer, blah, blah, blah.
Right. And so you wouldn't be it shows that it's genuinely by the officer. And I can see the mindset.
That was what we did back
right.
then. And then you give them all the scientific reports. You give them all we gave them all the photos. They had all the photos, which would come up later with Seiler and his shuffle
of
the photos.
Well, and even then, the photos you weren't required.
You didn't have to give them the
right.
photos. We gave them the photos
because you were thinking maybe it will inspire him.
Well, he's here's what the scene looked like. I have an interpretation of it. We'll see what you can do with it.
Right.
And what we did not do, and then the rule back then, and at the time we were under what's called the Brady Rule,
mm-hmm.
which was that you, to ensure that the prosecution was not being flim-flammy or secretive with evidence and hiding evidence, we took the entire file and copied it, and you give it to the judge, which
right.
was Judge Oliver.
For
and the judge
an in-camera inspection.
Is to do an inspect, to look through it and see if there's anything in there that we didn't give the defendant that they have a right to have. Okay. Not to give them things they don't have a right, but just as a check on the evil prosecutors. And
because we are all right, obviously, according to the media, evil.
We're all evil. Now, I will say this. Prosecutors don't always do themselves a favor because there are some bad apples out there.
That's true.
And they ruin it for everybody.
That's true.
But they're by far fewer than, and you see, and we'll talk about why the defense has this incentive to do whatever they have to do to win in
right.
the United States, not other countries, but in this country.
Right.
But, so we did that. We gave everything to the judge. Boom, boom, here we go. Now, we start in the trial, and I'm thinking, they don't seem very, how are they going to do this? Well, first up is Joe Burton. He's their witness. Now, he had been here three times. He'd been here in the Mercer case, kidnapping case.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been here in another case of an elderly woman who was killed. Someone broke into her apartment. Oh, Lord. She was 80 plus years of age.
She was raped and killed, wasn't she?
Raped and killed.
Yeah.
She was killed because she was essentially crushed. And her head was put through the sheetrock of the house she was in.
People are evil.
Yes. Joe Burton testified in that case because it was a death penalty that I retried because they reversed it and we had to retry the death penalty phase.
And I did that. What was the name of the defendant in that one? I've forgotten. It starts with a B, if I remember right.
Blankenship.
Yeah, Blankenship. He was tried a bunch of times, retried on sentencing a bunch of times.
So I did it. And Joe Burton testified at the original trial. And I don't want to misquote him because I don't remember exactly. But he basically testified to the injuries that they weren't really that serious. Because the allegation of the defense was that she had a heart attack later or something. It was ridiculous. It was obscene. And he testified to things in the Mercer kidnapping about a clock and a watch and things that are just so off the wall. Well, apparently he will say anything. And there's a lot of evidence about him later on in life. He's not with us anymore. But I can tell you about a conversation I had with the ex-district attorney from Cobb County about Joe coming to his office later in life, and I'm talking maybe 5 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Trying to get the DA to let his girlfriend go, who was accused of a big, she was a quite young druggie addict. And
that's
he wanted him to do him a, Joe was a problem. Joe had issues later in life, but at the time, he basically was a hired gun. He would testify for the defense. He testified for Cook all the time. Mm-hmm. And he came here, and he shows up. And so the way that we divided the case up, I tried the case with Spencer.
Mm-hmm.
And Spencer's role was he ran the case, he ran the trial. But he also was Williams' nemesis. Williams couldn't stand him.
Obviously.
And so Spencer cross-examined him, got, how many, four times? And he just, it was seeing him on stand with Spencer, it was like watching somebody just who wanted to explode and couldn't. And Spencer
Which
knew
is
it.
Perfect, right.
It's perfect because Spencer was so calm. So calm and so reasonable. And yet, anyway, so I had the experts.
Mm-hmm.
So here's Joe Burton. And he starts off, and this gets at what you're talking about. He starts off with a diagram of the scene. It's not to scale. It's got the body in the wrong place. Okay? The other thing is,
had he actually made that diagram?
No.
Yeah.
So his excuse on cross was, well, I didn't really prepare it, and I only saw it this morning. This is the
What's the foundation for the admissibility of or use of this diagram is what I would have to question.
Well, we would at that point. That was already in.
Right.
But
exactly.
You didn't know. How
would
you think that
know?
He had nothing to do with withdrawing it? I mean, who would do that? What expert? Well, he would. So this is the point for prosecutors and all lawyers. You got to really watch and be careful and listen and don't be taking notes because things happen in front of you and you're like, wait a minute. Because you expect
or having extra pairs of eyes. I think that has always been something that I really appreciated later in my career. Once we started this major case thing, we would have two prosecutors. And honestly, when I started, you didn't. It was just me and the detective.
Right.
And sometimes the detectives were good and sometimes they weren't. And it was kind of like, well, hit or miss.
Yeah, it really does. But and that's why detectives were allowed to sit. So somebody.
Right, extra
but
eyes.
But you need extra
help.
Eyes. And today you've got people sitting there with laptops. I mean, there's something that comes up later with this testimony. Now, I'm jumping around a little bit, but since I had left after the first trial and I had been told, forever, everywhere I went, and Spencer will tell you this, everywhere I went, Brooklyn, LA, you name it, everybody knew about this book and knew about this case. And I would start
crazy.
To tell them, well, here's what really happened. And then they'd say, oh my God, what? Wait. And they'd say, you got to write a book about that. I said, I don't want to write a book. So I was in Savannah working on something else. And I'd heard it. And I said, I don't know what it. I can't write a book about all of them because I wasn't here for all of them.
Right.
But let me see. So I did. So I started into this book. But to get there, I said, okay, I have to review everything. I pulled every piece of evidence. I looked at evidence that wasn't admitted. I looked at every single piece of everything, photos that weren't admitted, things that weren't admitted. And I read every single transcript of the trials.
And it shows.
Spencer says, I didn't even do that. I said, well, you were there. You didn't have to. But when you can go back afterwards and you have a chance to sit back and look at things, you see things.
Oh, sure.
And things came up that I'm like, oh, my, I didn't notice. I would have noticed. And he said, I found something I'll tell you about that he didn't notice. He said, I never thought of that. And it's about autopsy photos.
Right.
Anyway, so on I go. So I go plowing through this case. And I'm looking at Joe Burton. Shows up. He's got a diagram he didn't, and this happens again with another expert, didn't draw the diagram. And the thing about the diagram that's very important is not just the chair, because that's a photo. It's where the body was, because supposedly Hansford had come into the study through that door. Mm-hmm. And if you go to Mercer House, you know, walk to the left, right inside the door. The desk was just to the left. That he walked around to the front of the desk. Now, why he didn't just shoot Williams from the door, because it's a clear shot. You know, he would have.
I would have.
I know you are. I know, and you should be. He walked around the desk and then delivers the great line that you brought. You know, I might be leaving now. You're leaving tonight. And fires at Williams. All right. Which puts him at the western end of the desk.
That's crazy.
His body is found. The feet are under the chair at the other end of the desk. And he fell straight down when he was shot. So how did he get into that position? Well, you look at the diagram that Burton used. He wasn't down there. They moved him
for the diagram. Nice.
Right? Right? So that's one thing he does, and we'll get to the cross. And then he has and he's talking about gunshot residue and how, and it's just boilerplate. It's boilerplate stuff. He says in every trial, he says, oh, that really doesn't mean anything because the absence of GSR doesn't mean anything. And here's a picture of a gun. Here's how the gun works. Well, he's got a picture of a revolver. He's using as an exhibit, which is not like a semi-automatic, because it doesn't open at the top.
Right.
And a Luger isn't even like every semi-automatic, because it has a hinge on it.
That is unusual.
It actually completely opens, and it's an ancient weapon. You know, it's a World War II version of this thing. So they're not as tightly made to specs as the modern, you know, Glock is, for example.
Right.
So, and this is what Dr. Howard said. He said, yes, normally, yes, you got to test the weapon. You don't know until you test the weapon. You have to test the weapon. Okay, fine. So he's using a revolver. That's not the weapon in the case. He had gotten here on Friday, the day before, you know, the week before trial, which I pointed out, and had looked at all this stuff. He testified about, what did he testify about? There were other things about blood alcohol, there were all this stuff. And I mean, he really doesn't know this case, which is shocking.
Because he's just testifying boilerplate crap.
Boilerplate crap.
Saying.
And I'm thinking, this is a big case. It's Bobby Lee Cook. Maybe Bobby Lee Cook's not all I thought, because this doesn't seem like what I thought was coming. And I'm just this young guy, doesn't know anything. I'm thinking, do I not know what I'm doing? Because this seems like they're spouting out smoke and it's not going to work. Well, then the fun part starts. Now, Larry Howard knew about Burton, of course. He knew, you know, he testified all the time against him. And he says, well, here's a little something that happened that you might want. Just tuck it away. I wouldn't use it if you don't have to use it. You know, just, but if you, a little something put up. And I had this little item tucked away. So we get to the end of cross. And Burton, so I cross Burton on all this stuff. He hadn't, you know, he had just seen hadn't seen the diagram. He has, this is not a revolver. This is like a so-and-so. Had he tested the weapon? No. Had he ever done a weapon test? Well, no.
He'd never done one ever.
Never. The reason is because, well, first of all, the state crime lab, their tests are inaccurate, according to Burton, because they use, I don't know the name, something spectrophotometry, blah, 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 but they don't use atomic spectrophotometry, which is actually very, very accurate. But what he didn't know was that they did use, their equipment had changed. They had the most modern equipment available in the world. And they had already testified to it. See, he didn't know with the testimony. He didn't even listen to what had been said on direct. We'd already presented our case.
Well, and wouldn't you think, you know, this big fancy lawyer would have thought, hey, I've now heard the testimony. Maybe I should ask my expert whether or not that makes a difference to his testimony.
You might have wanted to think about that. Well, he didn't know what Burton was going to say. So Burton gets up and says this, right? Well, then he says, have you ever actually tested, you know, it's important to test the weapon itself. Right. See if it gives off gunshot GSR first, and in what quantities. The crime lab had already testified. In fact, I got another phone call. This was during the time we were prepping for trial. Randy, forget his name. He was the...
Right, yes.
He was the forensics
guy.
Riddell,
I think.
Randy Riddell. Mm-hmm. He was the gunshot. He was that guy at the state crime lab in Atlanta. And so they had taken the weapon, and they tested the weapon. He said, yeah, I got to actually test the weapon. So I said, and the question being... You can't detect something that isn't there. So let's first find out if there's GSR, gunshot residue, is in fact generated or you know, from this weapon. So I call him up and I said, so you fired it, you tested it. He said, yeah, we did. I said, so does it give off like GSR? He says, clouds of the stuff. We don't. He says, I don't know if I've ever tested a weapon that gives off this amount of GSR. It blows out of the top of this thing, and it covers your hand. Like, oh, so that means we should have found it.
Yeah.
And there's a reason we didn't find it. But so I asked Burton if he'd, you know, ever, had he ever tested the weapon itself? Because you'd need to test the weapon itself. I couldn't even get him to agree with that because he just said GSR doesn't matter. I said, well, have you ever done weapon tests? He says, no, actually, I haven't, because there is not an atomic reactor in Atlanta that allows me to do those tests.
Which is crap, too.
I said, well, you ever heard of Georgia Tech? Which is where Howard had done 200-plus weapons tests.
Right.
And he's in DeKalb County. He doesn't know that Georgia Tech's in Atlanta. I mean, it's just, it's insanity.
That's
well,
nuts.
He's not very good. So, I had this thing, and there were two cases that Burton had been involved in. One, people in Georgia may remember it a long time ago, but it's pretty famous, pretty well publicized. And it was a case of a person found on, he had been on a railroad track, in a pickup truck, and was hit by a train.
Mm.
Okay. And died. Now, the postmortem was done under Burton's jurisdiction because it was in one of those counties, DeKalb, I forget which. And the cause of death was hit by a train.
All right. Forced trauma. Yeah.
Yeah, right? Crushed by, you know, he was in a pickup truck, hit by a train, he's dead. Well, there were some questions about that case. And it was later rechecked and the body was exhumed, as I recall.
Oh,
and Dr.
Yeah,
Howard
yeah, yeah.
actually did the autopsy. Mm. Or whatever you want to call it at that time.
Right.
All right. And found the gunshot wound in the man's head.
Yeah.
So.
I think you mentioned that in your book.
Yeah, I think I do. Burton had not done that autopsy. He had actually had an assistant do it, which is illegal.
Right.
But he had signed the death certificate.
Like he
had
done
it. And the report, as if he had done it. So two violations. First, he didn't find the fact that the man had been murdered. And secondly, he had done it by allowing someone he wasn't authorized to do it. So I go over this with Burton. Well, that really got him. So when I'm done, and I'm finished, I'm done with Burton.
Yep.
I sit down, and Bobby Lee Cook, who should have shut up, can't help it, and he gets back up for a little redirect. And he gets Burton to say that, you know, how many cases have you been involved in? Tens of hundreds of thousands. And this in all those cases. This is the one mistake you made.
Gosh,
one mistake. Like, fine. So he thinks he's got me, right? So he sits back down. So I stand up, and I said, have you ever heard the name? And I forget the child's name. I can't remember him. It was the name of a young black male who had been found in a creek in suburban Atlanta. And Joe Burton had done the autopsy.
Right.
And had set the cause of death as drowning.
Which it wasn't. It was strangulation.
Yeah. Well, later... Yeah. Come to find out. So I asked him if you've ever heard that name, and you could have seen his face.
Ash.
Yes. Wasn't it originally, I mean, you did the autopsy, it was supposed to be an accidental drowning. He had drowned in the water underneath this railroad trestle.
Mm-hmm.
He says, yes, I did say that. I said, isn't he in fact now on the list of Atlanta's missing and murdered children?
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was strangled and thrown from the bridge like a number of them were.
Right.
That trestle.
Right.
Well, that was it. So I was up, I'm examining Burton, and I turn around, and I walk back, and at the time, we had to pass the defense table, because they were not next to each other, they were behind. So I'm walking past Bobby Lee Cook, and he looks up at me, and he whispers, like a stage whisper, and he says, you son of a bitch.
And you're thinking, best compliment ever.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Well, you know, actually, Bobby Lee knew my father-in-law because my father-in-law was from Rome, and they, you know, they're pretty close up there to where he lived. And he saw him at a reception at some point years later, and he said something about, yeah, that's your son-in-law down there in that case. He said, he's all right. Yeah, well.
Well, and that's kind of him. That is kind of him.
So I said, the guy considered the son of a bitch to be a compliment to coming from him. I mean, it's pretty good.
Sure.
So we win the case. Big time. We win the case.
But there's something weird that happens right before the jury gets charged.
Right before the jury gets charged.
Okay.
And I must tell you, because this is not for your audience necessarily, but it's just for you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm standing at this table when they announced the verdict guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Spencer's standing next to me. And I turned to him and I said, is there something wrong with feeling this good about someone else's misfortune? He says, no, I don't think so.
No, I don't think so either.
But meanwhile... before the jury was charged, Bobby Lee asked for to see the judge. All right, oh boy, here we go. This is going to get a little complicated, but not too, maybe not too much. There had been an earlier incident at the house, at Mercer House, involving Williams and
Hansford.
Right,
the April incident.
April incident.
Right.
Okay, basically right at 30 days mm-hmm. earlier. The police had called. Interestingly enough, Anderson was the one who went to that call. So he knew about it.
And he was cross-examined about it in this
And he was
trial.
Cross-examined about it.
Right.
Because in the prior incidents, supposedly, this was Williams' story, Hansford was again raging and high and smoking and doing all this stuff, and he had taken a gun, I don't know if it was a Luger or not, and had been out firing, had been firing the gun all over and shooting at the trees. And so in the April incident, when Anderson had come to the house, Williams had met him in the foyer and said, "He's upstairs, he's armed, you'll never take him alive." Again, bad dialogue from a bad movie. Anderson and the other officer with him go upstairs, and they find Danny Hansford passed out on the bed. And he says...
Wait. You're never going to take him alive, but he's asleep?
So he was alive still, I'm assuming. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I know. He's armed, and you're never going to take him alive. I'm like, okay.
Whatever.
So up he goes. Hansford's probably passed out. I don't think he's asleep. He's passed out. He was certainly a rambunctious guy. He was a handful. Danny Hansford was a handful. But that was fine. Williams liked it. Anyway, he kept him in his house.
It was a turn on.
He lived in his house. He bought him presents. He was his guy. He was caught him off the street. He brought him in off the street. Okay. So Williams says, and this is in Anderson's report, that in the report it says that Williams showed us a bullet hole in the carpet. Because supposedly Hansford had upstairs had fired the gun into the floor.
Right.
All right. Anderson says, we looked for the bullet. We pulled the carpet up. There's no sign. There's a gouge in the floor. There's a hole, but there's no bullet anywhere. We can't find anything. There's no lead. There's no nothing in the room.
Right, which is weird.
Which is beyond weird. But it's in there. Fine. Well, here we go. We go to trial. Now, this is much later because it's the trial of the thing that happened in May.
Right.
And they examine him. Well, what about this thing? What about this? Because they're trying to... I don't even think that the May incident... I could have argued that it wasn't even admissible.
You're talking about April?
The prior incident.
I kind of agree with that, but yeah. Okay.
But you kind of don't want to...
It's a prior difficulty, so maybe it comes in.
But we got a chair on his leg. I'm not too worried about that.
Right.
And I wasn't running the case. It doesn't matter. But I don't think it was critical. And it's like, we'll tell him everything. We're fine. We gave him the pictures. We'll do all this. We're being nice.
Right.
So they cross-examine Anderson about it. Well, didn't you go upstairs? Didn't he tell you about the bullet? And he says, that's what's in my statement. Because of what I said earlier about how we gave the defense their material.
The statement
of Williams that he had made, because this is in the report, it gets complicated. This is in the report of the May incident.
The murder. Right.
Yeah, it's not an incident, is it? It's a murder.
It's a murder.
So because Anderson answered both calls, he talked about the earlier call from April in his supplemental report about
May.
He makes a reference to it, which you're really required to do, and he did. That part of the report is blacked out because it's not Williams' statement, and that's what we give the report. We black that out. We leave the statement. Today you give them everything.
Right.
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 So, whether that's right or wrong, we do it anyway. That's what you do. So they had that.
Mm-hmm.
And we go back into the judge's chambers, and I'm thinking, what is he up to? We had no idea. What is he up to?
Yeah.
And he says, I'm paraphrasing, he says, we understand that there is something in Corporal Anderson's report that contradicts his testimony on the stand about the April incident. All right. So Spencer didn't do all of that stuff. I did. I
was the one. You're a discovery guy.
I'm the guy, and I handled I handled Anderson's testimony. I handled the expert's testimony, blah, blah, blah. So that was my area.
Right.
So he just looks to me, and I knew that report, and I knew it inside out. I knew everything that was in it.
Right.
And I said, well, it's inconsistent with his testimony, because I didn't think it was. And I said, well, they looked at me, And the first thing I said was, because of what I said about how we did the Brady material and that we put it all in a file and gave it to the judge,
right?
My first comment was, well, the easiest way to find out is to look at it.
Right. It's
sitting there in the office.
Right.
Pull it out and look at it. I don't know what it says. I mean, I know what it says, but you don't have to take my word for it.
Right.
I didn't say all that. I just said the easiest way to find out is to look at it.
Right.
I said I don't think so. But right. The easiest way to find out is to look at it. Now,
well, and I know you're telling me too that, you know, you remember everything in it. You remember the essence. I've been in that situation.
You know.
You've had adrenaline, you've been, you know, trying to keep track of all of your witnesses and cross-examine people, and you're exhausted. And while you know it, I don't have a photographic memory. Maybe you do.
No,
I don't.
I don't. I don't.
And so the one thing that became a big deal in this, I don't think I would ever have even, it would even have registered with
me. It made no sense.
In that context.
I had no idea what they were talking about. And and I had talked to Anderson about this. About the prior incident, about what it might have meant. Spencer and I had gone back and forth about it. Do you think he was setting it up? And I thought maybe at the time I didn't think it made sense.
Right.
I think later, I think I know what Williams did was that he jumped back to that and used it later after, and the way that he set up the May killing to reflect stuff that had happened in April. But I don't think he did it in advance. But I knew all about the report. I knew I had talked to Anderson about it. I knew what was in it. In my mind, I understood that he had showed him the hole. There was no bullet.
Right. And so
the problem is there's no butt in the report.
Right. You've got two reports. You've got the April report, which, of course, in the context of what you're talking about, if I'm in chambers and we're talking about the April incident, I'm thinking of April report. Right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so I'm not thinking about
the May reference to the April report. No.
But in the May report, when he refers back, he says something about the damage to the floor.
Yeah.
In April. What does he say that becomes such a big deal?
Well, he calls it a bullet hole. He says he showed me a, and he didn't phrase it the way I might have.
He said something like fresh or something?
Fresh bullet hole. He showed us a fresh bullet hole in the
thing. As opposed to just a bullet hole?
Or if he said he showed us what he said was
a bullet hole,
which is the way I guess I heard it in my head because I'd been over it with him. And I knew, you know.
Right.
Well, he didn't find it. And I said, do you think he did it with a poker? Do you think he said, I don't know what he did, but we couldn't find a bullet. I'm like, well, it was either a bullet hole or it wasn't a bullet hole. I don't know.
But when he testified, Anderson called it a bullet hole, didn't he?
I'd have to go back and look at the transcript. My recollection is that he just used his statement to cross-examine him. He said, did he show you a bullet hole in the what he said or what? I don't remember. But it was certainly inferred that it was a bullet hole.
Did Anderson disagree with that?
Now you're asking me things I don't remember.
Well, I recently read your book and, of course, read the book.
Oh, so you know the answer to that, but I don't.
Yeah, the answer to that is he refers to it as a bullet hole. He just doesn't use the term fresh.
Okay. But then he doesn't explain himself.
So is this some sort of material anything?
No.
That's not inconsistent. That's not an inconsistency.
I didn't think it was. I heard it. I sat in I heard the testimony, and I thought, well, okay, yeah. That's what he did. Now, what Anderson didn't do and what great experts will do, and he certainly
wasn't an expert, he's a patrol officer.
Yeah, patrol officer. He had some experience, but he was not an expert witness.
Right.
What Dr. Larry Howard did later, and others did later, and the forensics officer did later, is they know what is going on, and they understand the import of the question.
Right.
And if you're an expert and you're testifying, well, if you're not an expert and you have an answer, you're entitled to explain it.
Right.
If it's not in context.
Right.
So what Anderson could have said at the time was, he showed me a bullet hole in the carpet, but I didn't know if it was a bullet hole or not.
Right.
And he could have gone on and said that. He just didn't offer it, and it wasn't asked, and it was skipped over like it was gone. He never talked to Anderson. Was on the stand for no time at all. Okay.
Right.
So it didn't register to me. So then Williams, now we're in chambers.
Right.
And he says, and then Cook says, is there anything inconsistent with this? And I'm thinking, well, I don't think so, but you can look at it. It's right there. You know,
and
why don't
nobody
we look at it?
Does anyone even bother to look?
No. Cook says, and here's where I confess that I think this is my fault, is just being young and being impressionable and not knowing any better and not knowing to not let the fact that Bobby Lee Cook took us back there to do that had to mean something.
Well, and in chambers. I mean, that is...
Yes.
Yeah.
He's not going to do that. And then he also claimed how he knew about it was that he had a source within the DA's office that had told him that that Anderson had lied on the stand.
Who was that supposed to be?
I think I know who it might have been, but they didn't tell him what he said they told him. But
I'm
of course,
not shocked by that.
Confidential. Mm-hmm. Anonymous source within the DA's office. Now, so I say no. And then I say, what happens? In chambers, Cook says, no, that's fine. And that's where I should have said, wait a minute. Let's pull it out here. So something's going on.
Well, but I didn't. Well, and you say that having been in this, not this exact situation, but having been accused of stuff in front of judges and you want to clear things up for the record, a lot of times our judges would be like, oh, you know, well, he's letting it go. Let's just not.
Yeah.
And so you go along with it because you think that's okay.
But some judges might have stopped and said, hold on a second. Let's clear this up. What is this about?
And that makes me happier. It's like, because you know, and I know, it isn't there.
No.
It isn't there.
And the point that came up now and then later, of course, it goes up on appeal. So we win the case. Boom, boom, boom. It goes up on appeal. Supreme Court is looking at it.
Right.
They actually looked at that exchange and what was in Anderson's report. The other point we made on appeal, and David Lockwood testified to this because David actually handled all the appeals.
I'm going to drag David into this.
He knows this case inside and out better than I do. He argued these cases. He's at the Supreme Court trying to argue this thing, and he's saying, wait a minute. He offered to look at the file because they had claimed that we had concealed this evidence.
Right.
How did we conceal it? By putting it in the file that we gave to the judge to examine.
How did we conceal it? By saying, hey, let's go look at it right now.
What does that? That doesn't make any sense.
No. And I've been in that situation too, where you're like, let's straighten it out right now. Let's do it.
To your point about the media and about how prosecutors are seen at some point, they assume that you want to hide this evidence and if you can get away
with it.
Which is bullshit. Why would you do that? Because it makes no difference. You don't want to. Anyway, but that's the assumption.
Right.
So the Supreme Court of Georgia finds prosecutorial misconduct. Now, this is supposedly what I did, prosecutorial misconduct. Now, at the time, I was in Atlanta. I was the Consumer Utility Counsel for the state, working for Joe Frank, running that agency. I was probably 2,000 yards away in my office when they're arguing this case before the Supreme Court.
Right.
And if I had known that that's what they were talking about over there, I would have walked over and given them an earful.
But
I had no idea.
Right. And Davis says, they would listen to you anyway.
They wouldn't listen to me. They would listen to Bobby Lee later, though.
They probably listened to Bobby Lee at the time.
He testified to facts not even in his appeal. Anyway.
That's insane.
So they reversed the decision based on prosecutorial misconduct and something I had done to the fact-finding process. I was dumbfounded.
Distortion or some kind of thing.
I was dumbfounded.
I'm sure.
This is insane.
Yeah, I'm sure. I will follow up with Depp in two more episodes to be aired later. But in episode 2, we will get to hear from the law enforcement expert the courts shut down, Everett Reagan. Everett is one of the best in the business, and it's a real treat to talk with him about any case, let alone this one. On behalf of Inside the Bar, I want to thank a whole lot of people who helped me come up with ideas for this show and have contributed to my ability to even put it together. Probably number one on this list is Jim Ogletree, whose music you get to hear. The piece that is included in this show is Glimmer of Hope, which is fantastic. You can get more of Jim's music by following Glimmer of Hope on Instagram and also by checking out SoundCloud.